This episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast is brought to you by ComAvia, delivering leading-edge media to the aviation industry. ComAvia, the company the aviation industry turns to for the best in new media marketing communications. Visit them at commmavia.com. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 321 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and with me is David Vanderhoof, our official Airplane Geeks historian. Hey, David.
Hey, Max. Good to be back. It was a nice week off, but I'm glad to be back, and our Facebook fans will be happy about what I'm going to do tonight.
Why don't we tell folks right now what is the topic of this week's history segment?
We had a bunch of people shouting out because I posted an article about the Beechcraft Starship, and they said that would make a great history segment, and I cowered to the audience, succumbed, and that's what we will be doing. The 53 aircraft that everybody thinks is one of the world's greatest aircraft, but after my article, we might need to revisit that. Revisionist history, how shall we say.
All right. Well, Rob Mark is off at the NBAA conference, so he won't be joining us this episode, but we do have Max Trescott joining us. Hello, Max.
Hey, it's Rob's alter ego here from the West Coast. Hi, folks. How are you?
Very good. Glad to have you back. It's always great to have you on the show, Max.
And I'm happy to pinch hit from time to time. Thanks for inviting me back.
And our guest this episode is Binay Wilson, the aviation queen. Hey, Binay.
All hail the queen.
You're back. Binay is now a co-editor-in-chief at Airways News. And, you know, Binay, we mention you all the time on the show, and I think it's been a long time since we've done the full, complete, formal introduction. So for our newer listeners, I'm going to launch into it, and hopefully you won't be blushing too much on the other side of the Skype line here. But, of course, Binay is a longtime aviation journalist and blogger. And she's covered the industry for really a lot of different media outlets, including About.com for Cranky Flyer, the ACINA Centerlines, Aviation International News, Airport World, and the Airline Passenger Experience Magazine. Previously, she was the e-newsletter and social media editor at AOPA. I think that was your most recent position before joining Airways News. And she was also an editor at Aviation Week and Aviation Daily. And she's also served in the past in senior communications positions at the Regional Airline Association, Mesa Air Group, Rolls-Royce North America, and even Delta. Binay, you've really been kicking around this industry quite a lot.
Yes, I have. I remind myself of that quote by Eddie Acker when he was the chairman of Air Florida. Once you get hooked on the airline industry, it's worse than dope.
Yeah, I think it's true.
Yeah, that's a shout out to Great Aviation Quotes and Dave English. It's one of my favorite quotes, and it's so true.
Fantastic. All right, coming up, we've got an Australia desk. Steve Vischer is back home after visiting the U.S., so I think we're going to hear about his Qantas A380 flight, the Red Bull Air races that he attended in Las Vegas, and some more topics as well. Also, we have an Across the Pond segment from Peter Johnson. He talks with the amazing Marissa Garcia. Marissa is another very interesting blogger, journalist that really knows her stuff. We've got some news coming up. And we'll finish off with just a little bit of listener mail that we received in the past week. So if everyone's ready, well, let's start off with some aviation news. You guys all ready?
Ready.
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 Ready. Our first story is about a Mitsubishi who has just rolled out the first MRJ, the Mitsubishi Regional Jet. In fact, Binet, you wrote an article about that in Airways News, and we also have an article from Flight Global on the same topic. So this is a really significant event, I think, in a lot of different ways. But what they've rolled out is the first flight test aircraft, and that was on October 18th, first flight test aircraft for the MRJ program. There are two other flight test aircraft in final assembly, and eventually they look to have five aircraft for flight test and three for ground test. Now, Binet, this is there's sort of a milestone associated with this in terms of Japanese commercial passenger aircraft.
Yes, I actually was up at 1:30 in the morning on Saturday watching the live stream, and it was amazing how many of the av geeks were up watching it too, because I was also kind of throwing some tweets out there as I was watching it. And I think what's so significant about this is it's the first domestically produced aircraft since the YS-11. And when I was listening to the chairman of Mitsubishi, I mean, they're very proud of this airplane. They have seen this as a dream, getting back into the commercial aviation side of the business. And, you know, this rollout was a pretty big deal for them.
Now, there's two versions of this jet, ultimately, right? A 70-passenger model and a 90-passenger model. Do you know which this first flight test aircraft was, Binet? Because I didn't see that reported.
No, I didn't either, and they did not mention that. They just rolled it out, and, you know, everybody was there giving their speeches and salutations. I think the bigger thing with this is, you know, I think it was in my headline, you know, that it rolled out after a four-year delay. And, I mean, if you look at the 70 and 90-seat larger regional jet market, I mean, we've got Bombardier and we've got Embraer who have been in there for quite a while. And on the kind of edges, we still have the Avro RJ kind of out there, too. Mm. So the big question that I have is this jet, you know, is there enough room in the market for this jet at this point? Because, you know, they've come very late to the market, and now they're looking at deliveries by 2019. I mean, it's going to be interesting to see what the market for this particular jet segment looks like.
Yeah, and I've seen some different numbers for the number of orders that they have on the books, but it's a little under 400, it seems to be, depending on whose numbers you look at. But SkyWest is the big customer so far with 100 firm and 100 option orders. That really helped the program, I think, in terms of, you know, kind of giving it some legs and getting it going. But yeah, it's interesting to see or to contemplate where it may go. The MRJ, of course, has the Pratt & Whitney PW1200G engine, which is a geared turbofan engine, smaller than what you'd find, of course, on the Bombardier C-Series, which is also what Embraer is going to be using for their new E-Jets. So you talk about where's the market or how large is the market or something. And I mean, the efficiency of sort of the new generation of engines would, I don't know, I guess would probably contribute to supporting that market.
I just kind of wonder with 70 seats, so many of the RJs have been, you know, retired because they were too small and too efficient. Is 70 kind of on the threshold of where, hey, there might not be as big a market for it anymore as there was 5-10 years ago?
I think that Max has asked a very good question. And I mean, I also look, you know, I'm going back to my regional aviation days, and I look at, I mean, and when I see this, I think about the Saab 2000, which was a beautiful high-speed turboprop that came out, but it was kind of behind its schedule, and it had the misfortune of coming out finally right as the 50-seat CRJ craze started. So, you know, it never really launched. I mean, you know, it had some customers, but it was never, there were never enough orders to make it viable.
You know, Binet, this is a sort of an interesting aspect of commercial aviation. The timing can count for so much. I mean, with lead times that are so long, with development lead times that are as long as they are, certification lead times, flight testing lead times. It's when you kick off a program, it's kind of impossible to know what the economy will be like 10, even more years into the future, what the sweet spots will be, what the missions will be that the airlines are looking for. It's kind of a crapshoot.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. And it's a big gamble. And, you know, I remember when Embraer decided that they were going to do the 70 and 90 seat jets. It was a huge gamble because at that point we were still, regional airlines were still constrained by scope clauses and it was very rigid. And, you know, Embraer was betting that that would loosen and the market would kind of uptick from 50 seat jets. And it turns out they were right.
It might be kind of interesting for some researcher to kind of look back across the history of commercial aviation and identify these sort of big bet your company moments. And how often did the bet come through successfully, and how often did it go the other way? I don't know what the ratio is. Maybe it's even. Maybe it's 50-50. Hopefully it's better than that, but I don't know. It might be interesting to kind of think about what that might be. All right, let's move on to our next item. This is something that's, of course, very much in the news these days, and this is about the spread of Ebola. And we talked about this a little bit last week as well. We have an article from Business Insider titled, "Researchers Studied How Airport Screenings Impact Ebola's Spread, and the Results Are Troubling." So this comes from researchers at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, and they wrote an editorial in the BMJ. The BMJ, that's formerly the British Medical Journal. I don't know why they now want to be the BMJ. I think British Medical Journal sounds better. But they talk about how it's very difficult to screen out sick people at the airport, and they talk about three ways that that can be done in sort of some of the problems and shortcomings of each. Maybe I'll take the first one and then you guys can kind of chime in. But the first one they mention is with a thermal scanner. This is a device that detects if you have a fever in sort of an automated fashion. But they point out that even if you started out with a fever because you're ill, that you can break that fever with aspirin. Or if you're carrying a disease like Ebola or anything else that might cause a fever, that you may not have the fever yet. That may be something that's still to come. And finally, they point out that if you do have a fever, that this certainly doesn't mean that you have Ebola. So thermal scanner, kind of an interesting piece of technology, but in terms of finding, identifying truly sick people moving through the airport, it's not such a effective means. But there's a couple other things they can do, too.
Oh, sure, the flight itinerary. Hmm. I think I had read that there are, 150 people per day who are coming into the United States alone from the three countries in West Africa that they're most concerned about. And so obviously countries are now screening for where people are arriving from, not just on their inbound flight, but also any connecting flights that may have brought them to the last flight to coming into the country. So that actually does seem like it would be a little bit more effective than the thermometer test that can be easily beaten with some aspirin.
Now, one thing they point out is that there are three countries that are most affected by Ebola: Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. And there are not a lot of direct flights from those countries to the major international airports. That typically those people come in from or via connecting flights, which means that you have to check through all these itineraries of the passengers and see where they came from. So that could be a little problematic or generate potentially a lot of work at a really busy airport. So that's the second way, the flight itinerary.
Just one more thing on that. When you have these people coming from these countries, I mean, my question is, do these airports have the technology, or the airlines have the technology over there to go through all of these manifests? Mm. Or are these people getting on the plane and getting to Europe? And I mean, who's responsible for screening them then? I mean, that's
right.
That's also my big question.
Right. It's not so straightforward.
No.
And then they offer up a third method.
Oh, I'd love to jump in on this one.
Okay. Go ahead, Vinay.
You know, I'll just tell a quick story. I had gone to Indonesia for the rollout of the Indonesian aerospace IPTN N250 and ate something that didn't agree with me. And I was not feeling well on the day of departure, but I did not want to stay in Indonesia. I wanted to go home. So, you know, they were asking questions and I'm not proud, but I said, no, I'm fine. I just had a little too much. You know, I was just a little overstressed. But when I got to Hawaii for the first leg from Indonesia to Hawaii, there were nurses from the Centers for Disease Control handing out brochures saying, you've just left a cholera-infected area. If you have these symptoms, please see your doctor when you get home. Hmm. And guess who had all the symptoms? Well, I mean, long story short, I got home and it turns out I didn't have cholera. But saying that all to say, if you're looking at this questionnaire and, you know, sometimes people will tell the truth and sometimes they won't.
Exactly.
You know?
Right.
Well, unfortunately, they have a strong disincentive for lying as well. For example, if you're on a refundable ticket, or a non-refundable fare, are you really going to tell somebody, oh, yeah, I might be sick, take me off this plane?
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. So that third detection method, the questionnaire, that also has a lot of problems for the reasons that you guys are stating. This group kind of looked at all these, and they said that in reality, airport screening would still let 93% of people with Ebola slip through the cracks. So the point being that while you'd love to screen passengers and prevent the spread of things like Ebola, it's very difficult. They also mentioned sort of the results from the SARS epidemic in Canada back in 2003 used a testing procedure to keep SARS out of Canada. And as part of this procedure, it says that 700,000 passengers were screened at the Canadian airports. Close to 2,500 answered yes to the SARS questionnaire. And of those 2,500, exactly zero were found to have the disease. Same thing in Australia. Australia's airports screened close to 2 million people for SARS, and they found about 800 with elevated temperatures. They held them for additional testing, and guess what? Same thing. Turned out no one had the virus. So these screening policies, I don't know. I guess maybe they could make some people feel good, like somebody's doing something, but in the end, it's not really an effective means.
We got to do something. I ran into an article just a couple of weeks ago in the Journal of Science, and they were talking about the spread of HIV in, believe it or not, the 1920s and 30s. And I didn't even realize HIV went back that far. Yeah. In the Congo, and what they found, one of the major factors there was the rail system. Were it not for the trains, it would not have spread as widely as it did. So I think, you know, transportation clearly is the you know, the biggest threat we have for any pandemic in the future.
That's right. It's so easy to spread since people are so mobile, and obviously the availability of commercial aviation makes that even more likely to happen. So we have a problem, and at least the four of us don't really have something to offer up as a solution, at least as it comes to aviation.
Well, at least we know what the problem is. That's a start.
All right. So let's move on. We have an item in Air Force Times. This is a race against time. More people, money needed to keep aging fleets flying. So what they're talking about is U.S. military aircraft that are very old. They've been used extensively in combat in the recent past. And sequestration, on top of all that, is really affecting mission capability in a pretty negative way. David, what do you think about this? What can you tell us about this?
This is a great article. It had some eye-opening stats. You know, we've talked about in the past, we've joked about how old the B-52s are and how old the KC-135s are. But the average age of our fleet in its entirety in the United States Air Force is 27.2 years. And if you think about it, F-22s are almost getting to the point of being 20 years old, the original ones that we had purchased. So we haven't really had a break in combat operations since the mid-90s. And it takes a lot to fly these aircraft. And the older the aircraft become with no replacements, the more time and more unserviceable they've become. We, you know, in the civilian world, they're constantly replacing fleets of aircraft. You know, I mean, look at how quickly Delta's phasing out the 747 because they have the new 777s coming online, etc. Not so in the military. And we've got aircraft that we're trying, like the B-1 is down to a 47% activity rate. Now, granted that we're seeing them fly over Syria and Iraq, but it's a lot of work to keep these flying, and it requires more man-up power. And now, of course, with sequestration, there's not the money there to buy the spare parts to keep these flying. It's a very telling article that we've got a real crisis coming, and it's probably going to be coming sooner than later.
I have to agree with David. And, you know, when I read the article, I was just surprising to me because I, you know, David knows I'm not really, really into the military side. But, you know, my dad is a retired Air Force colonel, and one of his jobs, he was the deputy base commander at Edwards Air Force Base. And one of his duties was kind of not overseeing, but being the liaison to the Air Force when they were testing planes. And I remember they were testing the B-1 bomber and the B-2 bomber when I was in college. So, and we all know that I am well past my college years now. So, it's
oh,
just
not that
you know.
Past. Well, it depends. How many years did you spend in college?
I did it in 4 years.
I couldn't resist. Yeah.
But it's just kind of sad. But this is also a bigger story in that, you know, people, you know, budget season's coming up and people are now jockeying for position to get their money so that they can, you know, fund the programs that they need to fund.
Being another Air Force brat, you bought all the niceties at the beginning of the year. Now is the time to beg for things like fixing the hangar, the hole in the hangar. You know, because you built the base command or something new in the end. One of the most interesting things about this is we're training our pilots on the T-38C Talon fleet with a 66% mission capable rate. So that means 44% of the time our pilots who are learning to fly aircraft don't have aircraft to fly. In 2016, they're supposed to put in an RFP for new aircraft to replace the T-38. But we've seen in the last couple of years how long it took to buy tankers, how long is it to implement F-35s. It's a very telling thing, and it's kind of embarrassing to our diplomatic corps. If I switch over to another story, which was, this was from our friends down under. What's wrong with the White House planes? Carrier, it was grounded in Vienna. We have a fleet of 6 C-32s, which are 757s. And evidently, our Secretary of State, Kerry, is having to fly coach. I don't think he's actually flying coach because the C-32s keep breaking.
And I think that's happened 4 times this year. There's been some kind of a problem with his official plane, and he's had to ride commercial.
And if you think about, you know, the discussions that he needs to have and the timeliness of getting to where he needs to be, flying commercial, even if he's flying in first class, is just, it's not where our Secretary of State should be flying. It just isn't.
Yeah, I think the Iranians had a little fun with this last problem, didn't they?
Yeah, well, we've embargoed the Iranians since 79, and they're flying on Boeing 707s, and that break a lot because they don't have spare parts. So the Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif, quote, "So it's not just our planes," as he was sort of teasing Secretary Kerry, but someone on our Facebook page made the comment, what Boeing should do is try to sell the Air Force all of the early 787s that are sitting that they can't find airlines that want to buy. The only problem with that is, and this goes back to what we learned about the 767s, military aircraft like the C-32 may look like a 757, but internally they're quite different. The reason why the 767, the new KC-46, is being delayed is because the Air Force had them rewire the whole thing and have double redundant harnesses internally. Now, our C-32s are designed to have secure communications, and it would be a lot of money to go back into those 787s, even though they're sitting around doing nothing and would be great fuel efficient, to rewire them. And how long would that take to put all the military specifications into these aircraft? The 737s and the 757s that we fly, like the 747s, the VC-25s, they may look like airliners, but they're far from it. And you need to start thinking about, again, it goes to attrition. You know, we have a lot of shuttle diplomacy going on right now, and Kerry's racking up the hours, and we don't really want something to happen like they lose an engine or blow a tire like they did in one of the examples. So
I think I've got a great solution for Kerry and the White House. We have a small local high-tech company here in Silicon Valley that has a fleet of 757. So I think the next time the White House comes out to do a fundraiser here, they had to ask Google if they could also outsource the Air Force.
Outsource the Air Force.
Absolutely. They have Google fly these folks around. Oh, or dear. Do you remember the bumper sticker? I mean, this probably goes back 30 years ago. It'll be a great day when our schools get all the money they need and the Air Force has to hold a bake sale to buy a bomber.
I remember that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of like now they're both going to be holding bake sales. Yeah, exactly.
And Kerry does spend a lot of time in there. The article mentions that he's got nearly 1,220 flight hours, I guess, this year, which is that's a lot of flying. But, yeah, I mean, you've got to support the infrastructure.
Just think about the frequent flyer miles he could accumulate and save the taxpayers' dollars as he tries to book his flight to Tel Aviv with his frequent flyer miles. I mean, it would work. And my comment also was, when the Queen from Great Britain came over, they flew British Airways. When Prince, you know, when the royal family have been, they don't have their fleet anymore. They fly first class, so I admit that Secretary Kerry has a more of a secure nature, but there's something to be said for maybe we need to get rid of Miss Pelosi's private jet and give it to Kerry.
Well, I was going to say, think about the days in the 1970s with Kissinger going secret trips to China. I mean, that wouldn't have worked too well if Kissinger had to fly commercial to China.
All right. Well, one thing John Kerry can probably do on his plane is use his communication device, whatever that is, as much as he wants. But we have an article here. This is from the Daily Mail. And it mentions that the Association of Flight Attendants, or the AFA, has sued the FAA, saying that since passengers are allowed to use mobile phones, they ignore the safety announcements. And more than that, having all these smartphones out, well, if there's some kind of a situation develops and there's some turbulence or whatever, that these things could become dangerous projectiles if they weren't put away. So the AFA went after the FAA. They also say that, you know, this change, this isn't appropriate. Because the FAA didn't issue a NPRM, a notice of proposed rulemaking, or invite public comment, and therefore they really can't change the regulations. But there's some different views on this. I know we've talked about cell phones on planes before, mobile phones, and we've always sort of felt that, you know, let the airlines decide if they're going to allow them or not. But it's interesting to see the flight attendants taking this kind of action.
Oh, I'm not surprised at all. Everybody knows how I feel about cell phones on planes. There's no secret there. The ninth circle of hell. And I'm sorry, I think I have to go with the flight attendants on this. You know, I've been traveling lately, and I see how people are with their phones. I mean, even after the doors have closed and people are told, turn off your phones or, you know, put them in airplane mode, people are still merrily chatting away, surfing, sending emails, and, you know, even while we're still on the ground, rolling down the runway as the flight attendants are giving the safety message, people have just completely checked out.
Yeah, and I don't think there's any way to change that, really. I mean, people like their devices, and we've become a culture of just, you know, always being on them. To try to change that, that's kind of a difficult thing.
Well, they have no leverage as well. I mean, in the past, they could have said, well, if you don't turn them off, we won't give you your in-flight meal.
Yeah, now that's no real threat, huh?
Now it's just peanuts, if that.
The spokesman or someone representing the union says that the AFA is really mostly concerned about the stowage issue and that, you know, the danger that they represent. But a lawyer representing the FAA told the judges, this went before a three-judge panel with the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Washington, D.C. Circuit. And the government lawyer said that, well, you know, cell phones, they're no more dangerous than books or anything else that passengers may have out and not stowed. So he argues that this notion that the cell phones could become projectiles is kind of a weak one. And yeah, in a way, he's kind of got a point.
What did you say? I was on my cell phone.
That's good.
Very good, David. All right, let's move on. Another item. This is kind of an interesting item. This is from Forbes. You know, we seem to be having a lot of articles from Forbes lately. In the old days, back in the beginnings of the Airplane Geeks, we used to quote the Wall Street Journal a lot, but those guys went behind the paywall, so they don't show up as prominently as they used to. Forbes has risen to the occasion. But anyway, this is titled, Drone Pilots Beware. New FAA enforcement policy targets you, licensed pilots, at particular risk. Interesting. Licensed pilots. Well, we don't have licensed pilots for drones, for UAVs, do we, Max Trescott?
Well, actually, oddly enough, we do. There is a new ruling that just came out, what, a week or two ago when they approved the six movie-making companies in Hollywood to fly drones. They said in part that the people who operate those drones must have a private pilot's license. So it looks like going forward there will be some type of license required for anybody doing commercial work with drones. But for hobbyists, of course, there is no license required. But the FAA has kind of come at this from a different direction and basically said that they have now come up with a list of sanctions, fines, different levels of fines depending upon the severity of the offense, that they can come after people in civil actions if they violate drone rules, you know, if you fly higher than 400 feet, if you fly within 5 miles of an airport. But they went one step further, and they said licensed pilots should know better, and therefore their certificates are potentially at risk of being suspended if they break a drone rule. So imagine this. Max is out flying his drone, and both Maxes here on this show have drones, and happens to accidentally violate a rule. The FAA could come along and say, hey, we're going to suspend your pilot's license for 30 days, something they couldn't do to my neighbor who flies a drone because he doesn't have a pilot's license. So it just puts everybody on notice that pilots are now at greater risk of enforcement action from the FAA if there's a problem flying your drone.
That's right. And the FAA says that in this new enforcement guidance that they've issued is that if you're found in violation, that there are certain considerations that they will look at when they are trying to decide what they're going to do about your violation. One is whether or not this was a first time or inadvertent violation. The second is whether the violation involves a repeated or intentional violations. And the third is whether the safety risk resulting from the operation in terms, it says, of actual or potential endangerment to the national airspace was low, medium, or high. And like say, Max, if you have a pilot's license, that gets stirred into that pot in a way that's not going to be helpful if you're found to be guilty of violating what the FAA is intending to be the regulations for drones.
Yeah, those guidelines have existed for other aviation-related type investigations. Now what they're really saying is, and we're going to apply those to drones as well. This is all part of their order 2150.3, which I actually had to go through a year ago when I was being an expert witness in a case. And what they've done is they have a list of, and it's probably 150 pages of, you know, if you do this, it's going to cost you this amount of money. If you do this, it's going to cost you that much. They've just basically added to the list that already existed, and they've added drone violations.
Okay, Max, since our other pilot would never be caught dead flying a drone, but you do.
That being Rob.
Is it fair?
Wow. You know, in an odd sort of way, it may be. I mean, essentially what they're saying is if you're a licensed pilot, you really ought to know better, and so we're going to hold you to slightly a higher standard. So, yeah, there is an element of fairness to it, oddly, even though I don't like it.
Well, I mean, because I have my licenses for insurance. There's a expectation that basically I will do X, Y, and Z to not jeopardize those licenses, and I have guidelines. I mean, it seems to me that as a pilot, you are expected to know, you know, you wouldn't fly your aircraft dangerously in a pattern of an airfield. Why would you fly a drone? Those kind of expectations seems to me would carry over. And yeah, I think basically if you know better, you should be held to a higher standard.
And you're absolutely right, because it really goes to judgment. You know, if I were an FAA inspector and I saw a pilot do something irresponsibly that showed poor judgment with his drone, I could only infer from that maybe he's exercising, you know, poor judgment when he flies as well. And I'm sure there are people who are going to go, wait. No. I would never break a rule when I fly airplanes, but sure, I fly crazy when I fly my drones. You know, my experience has been that people that I have met who have had some risky behaviors that I thought were, yeah, maybe a little risky, often then went on to do other bigger things that I never would have imagined that they would do based on the one small risky thing that I saw them do. So I think it is a red flag, and yeah, probably is appropriate.
Well, Max, let me ask you a question, because, you know, when I read this, you know, when I was at AOPA, you know, we had a lot of discussions both internally and externally about drones and their place in the national airspace system. And it seems like to me, the FAA is just continuing to work through this whole thing about, you know, what drones are appropriate, when usage is appropriate, when it's not. And they seem to still be figuring it out. So if they're still figuring it out, is it really right to punish people if everything is not solidified on who can and can't and what it can be used for and not be used for?
Yeah, and I think if we had a Cerritos, like the accident in San Diego years ago where a commercial jetliner hit a private plane and that resulted in a whole new set of rules, if we had that kind of accident that involved a drone, everybody would say, oh, wait a minute, you know, we shouldn't have, you know, let drones do these things. And I'm sure the FAA is coming from it from a conservative standpoint of safety. You know, by saying no right now, they assure that there aren't going to be any accidents until they figure out how best to integrate these new types of aircraft into the national airspace system. So I can understand from a, you know, a government standpoint of, gosh, we want to try and stay safe. No is an easy, quick, you know, safe answer. Those of us who want to, you know, move forward and try new things, we're not happy with that. But from the FAA perspective, sure, you don't want to find that, you know, the next miracle on the Hudson was because an airliner took two drones into the, you know, into the engine intakes.
Good point.
For more about this and regular news, tune into the UAV Digest on Friday mornings with Max Flight and David Vanderhoof.
Yeah, that's right.
I now return you to your regularly scheduled podcast. Yeah.
Already in progress.
And what David says is right. This article in our conversation here has kind of been looking at it from the standpoint of pilots, because that represents more of our audience. But there's other interesting topics relating to this FAA move. Maybe we'll talk about that at the end of the week, David, that is sort of more broadly applicable to the unmanned vehicle interest group. But we'll keep it sort of focused on the pilots.
And let's be fair, okay, just so you folks know who are anti-drone on this show, it was the pilot currently on the show that put this story in. It wasn't Max and I.
Well, wait a minute. When you say Max or I think I put put it in here. Max T inserted that into the notes.
All right, let's move on to our main topic. Again, we're here with B'nai Wilson. B'nai, if you go over to airwaysnews.com, there's a lot of great stuff. And boy, your name is like all over these posts. You've been doing a lot of writing lately.
Yes, I have. I kind of liken it to drinking from the fire hose. I mean, I actually started before my official start date because my last day at AOPA was October 1st. And on October 2nd, British Airways brought in their first A380 to Dulles Airport. So, I had to try. I went out there and trotted out there and covered that story. And, I've just been at it full bore ever since.
So this is really about, at the high level, I guess, sort of the joining of Airways Magazine and the airchive.com site. And the new airwaysnews.com site is sort of the more timely, more news specific aspect or part of this collaborative agreement. Is that the right way to characterize it?
That is it exactly. We are like the web version for Airways Magazine.
How is the task divided up? Is it one staff that's both the magazine and the website, or are they still separate groups of people?
They are separate groups of people, but we do have people from the magazine side who contribute to the website. But there are a handful of us who write exclusively for the website, and we have the content that comes up every day. We try to do 3 or 4 stories a day to, right, keep things going. And then we'll get excerpts and we'll get pieces from the magazine that we'll run, and I'm still figuring that out myself. But, we've gotten some good content because the magazine is amazing. I mean, regular readers know, how good it is. And so I'm just happy that we do get access to that. And I think it complements what we're doing on the website because we're, our stories aren't as long, but, we do analysis. We look at the business side of things. We do trip reports and aircraft profiles, and we've got some really cool things coming up in the next few weeks. But if I told you now, I'd have to kill you all.
Okay. All right. The group, there's some familiar names in the sort of the lineup for Airways News. Of course, Chris Sloan, who we've had on the show before, and of course yourself, but Vinay is in there, and
yes,
Jason Rabinowitz is in there, and there's a number of really impressive folks who are doing the writing.
Yep, we've got Seth Miller from Wandering Aramean.
Yes.
He pops in. Isaac Alexander, we've got Taylor Michi. I mean, we've got a pretty good group of people. On Monday, last Monday, I was out at Dallas Love Field for the Southwest Airlines festivities, but Virgin America was also having its own festivities. So we had Austin Speaker, who was covering Virgin, and I was there covering Southwest along with Jack Hardy, which you guys will appreciate this. I call Jack Hardy Baby Dan Webb.
Oh.
Jack is
That's
amazing.
Quite a compliment.
It is. He's been writing for Airways since he was 16. Right now, he is a freshman at Embry-Riddle. And I had such a great time with him at Dallas Love Field on Monday. So I have actually, when we were kind of putting together, he did the social media and I wrote the story. And, you know, we actually did try to call Dan, but Dan did not pick up his phone. So for all you airline and manufacturers, you guys looking for a really good summer intern, call me. You got Jack is your guy. He's fantastic.
Very good. So. And good job of getting the plug in there for Embry-Riddle.
And it's also been really great working with Chris. I mean, we've talked on the phone a couple of times, but mostly it's been by email. And he has been such a help. And I mean, his archive of photos is just amazing. And his institutional knowledge about this industry. I mean, I respected him before, but just, you know, being on the inside and, you know, getting emails and kind of talking about events and things, it's just amazing how much that man knows about this industry.
I noticed there's some of the interesting topics that you've written about lately, that China to pass United States as largest passenger market. And I guess that comes from an IATA forecast, I guess.
Yeah, it's their first ever flight survey. It's the first one they've ever done. And I just thought that the numbers were in there were very interesting. And, you know, we always see these surveys coming by. So I also went and looked at the Boeing forecast and the Airbus forecast and the FAA aerospace forecast, which I put links to in the story. And, you know, they're all pretty similar, I have to say.
And I also see you wrote about the American first 777-200 with a new business class.
Yeah, that was actually Chris's idea because he's like down in the weeds. I mean, how he finds time to run his television production company too is just, I don't think the man ever sleeps. But, you know, he tossed that and he was like, you know, this just happened and didn't really see anything about it. So I just gave a quick email to the good folks at American. It's also been nice to get back in touch with a lot of people that I've known through the years on the commercial aviation side. And, you know, they sent us over some pictures and gave us some information. So we were able to just kind of get that out there.
Now, Binet, you're also continuing to keep up your own personal blog, aviationqueen.com. I see that there's lots of current posts there as well.
I'm trying. You know, at some point, something has to give because, you know, I've got the day job and I also still do the about.com air travel expert stuff. So, you know, in the end, the allegiance goes to Airways because that's the one that pays for Baby Digital's braces. So, you know, so I will try as hard as I can to keep up everything. But, you know, if something has to give, it's probably going to be Aviation Queen. And I hope it doesn't come to that point because I really do enjoy writing that. So
if it starts to come to that point, I think the part that you should hang on to is the strange but true aviation news.
Oh, that will never go away.
Okay.
I have way too much fun writing that because, you know, every week I have never had a week where I haven't had anything to write about because, you know, that just people continue to do stupid things on airplanes and in airports.
Do you have a favorite one you can share with us that's recent?
Oh, my goodness. I mean, I always enjoy the celebrities behaving badly.
Yeah.
For a while there, I was having a good time. It was like Naomi Campbell, the supermodel, was in for a span of a month. I mean, she actually got banned from British Airways for life because of her behavior. And the people who still think it's perfectly okay to bring a loaded gun through security.
It's shocking how often that happens.
It's amazing how complacent people must get about having guns if they don't even think about it.
Yeah, and I mean, thanks to the TSA, God bless them, every Friday on the TSA blog, they have a whole list of not only how many weapons were confiscated, you know, how many guns with rounded chambers, but also some of the more unusual weapons like the lipstick knife and the cell phone taser. I mean, and the sword, the guy who had the cane and it had a sword on the inside. Right.
Do they also tell you how many guns they let through that week as well?
I don't think they do that. I think they've got this down to a pretty fine science. I mean, I remember once I was taking a flight back from Stockton back down to Phoenix when I worked at Mesa Air Group. And Stockton is a small airport, so you pass through security and, you know, you're sitting there and you can see the X-ray machine, and I was sitting there.
I thought you were going to say you could see the end of the world from there.
No, you can just see the X-ray machine. And I was watching, and it came through, and it was clearly a gun. And I'm sitting there looking. I looked at the person next to me. Is that a gun? And we both were like, "That's a gun." And the screeners came out, and it was this elderly gentleman. And I mean, it was obvious that he had no idea. He was just confused, but. You know, you just wonder, you know, he had an excuse, but some of these other people, not so much.
Well, I don't know. Have you been in downtown Stockton? I think that's actually justified to carry a gun down there.
Yeah, it's an interesting place. I was flying there. My sister lives in Sacramento, but Mesa had direct flights out of Stockton. So I just drove up there because it was easier to catch flights there. So. But yeah, you're exactly right, Max.
No, and I'm kind of picking on Stockton. They were one of the, I think, three cities in the United States that had one of the worst fall off in housing prices. They went through some very tough times here after 2008. So it's not really fair to pick on them. They really did have some unfortunate things happen to them.
That's true.
Well, Bidet, why don't you tell our listeners all the places that they can find you online or the things that you're doing?
Well, I got to put in a plug for the day job. I'm handling the Twitter account, and there's some others too, but I'm doing most of it. Airways News on Twitter, and we also have a Facebook page, and we also have Airways Magazine has a Twitter account and a Facebook page. Come over, please say hello. I still have my Av Queen Binet account, and I'm joining the numbers. We're up to 6 people now on Google Plus, Binet Wilson, Binet J. Wilson.
The sad part of that is one third of your listeners on Google Plus are on this podcast.
Yeah,
that's true.
That's right. Hey, I'll sign up. I'll make it 7 for you.
I keep plugging away at Google Plus. I mean, I'm starting to see some benefits there. So
we have a pretty good sized Google Plus community for airplane geeks. I'm not sure.
Well,
what their
number is. You guys are the airplane geeks. Of course, you would have a good community Google Plus.
Well, thank you. You should come over and join us there.
I think I will. I definitely will do that.
All right. Binet Wilson, Aunt Binet, our favorite Aunt Binet, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. And I want to thank you for spending some time with us.
Thank you. The pleasure is always mine. And I guess I'll see you guys in June.
Oh, absolutely. If not before, if we can't arrange that some way, we'd love to.
That would be great. But I thank you guys so much for having me, and thank you for all of your support. And, you know, I'm a huge fan and continue to be so.
Oh, thank you. And us of you as well. And now here's Pete Combs from the National Business Aviation Association to tell us what to expect in the next NBAA Flight Plan podcast.
Hi, I'm Pete Combs, and if your business is flying, then you'll want to check out NBAA's Flight Plan. Whether you're flight crew, cabin crew, line crew, or maintenance, NBAA's Flight Plan is 5 minutes well spent on topics that range from safety to education to procedures both new and old. You'll find us on Apple's iTunes website or at the home of business aviation, NBAA.org.
Thanks, Pete. And now here's David Vanderhoof with the airplane of the week.
Okay, first a disclaimer. Uprisings on Facebook, this may happen once, but this will do not think that Facebook posts will cause me to write history segments going forward in the future. But tonight's subject is the Beech Model 2000 Starship. With a 50% market share in the 70s, Beech's King Air needed a replacement. In 1979, Beech set out to create a twin-engine turboprop that would move the company forward. The aircraft would be pressurized and use the latest building materials, composites. This would become the NGBA, or the next generation business aircraft. Beach then hired Bert Rutan and Scaled Composites to create an 85% scaled demonstrator. The result was Scaled Composites 115. The 115 was radical. It had two pusher engines. The benefit was a reduction in cabin noise, which would really never come. The vertical stabilizer was replaced with tip sails and a small downward fixed fin. Since it was a proof of concept, the 115 was not built using the same materials as the planned Model 2000, nor did it have pressurization or avionics. After a nine-month build, the 115 took to the skies on August of 1983. The aircraft completed its 100 flight hours 35 days later. It was a success. A major change to come out of the flight testing was the canard became a variable geometry wing instead of a fixed one. The 115 debuted at MBAA in Dallas in 1983, with a very optimistic 1984 first flight and 1985 certification. The Starship would be like every other advanced aircraft and would be plagued with contract troubles. It did have a great deal of firsts. It was the first certified all-glass cockpit and flight management system, the first certified all-composite business class aircraft, and it was the only aircraft certified with a composite wing, the first certified tandem wing or canard aircraft, and the first certified pusher. Eventually, the first of these three prototypes took to the skies on February 15, 1986. FAA certification did not come easy. How do you certify what you've never seen before? Sounds like our weekly discussion on the UAV Digest. Between 1986 and June 14, 1987, the three prototypes completed 2,000-plus hours to finally receive FAA certification. NC-4, the first production Starship, took to the skies on April 25, 1988. Overall, the flight test program cost over $300 million and had over a million man-hours. Upon certification, Beach only sold 11 airframes in the first 3 years. Unfortunately, it arrived just in time for an economic downturn. Also, a 10% luxury tax was placed on aircraft in the 1990 budget. To counteract that, in 1991, Beach was offering two-year leases on new Starships. Sales still lagged. After NC-28, Beach upgraded the airframe to the 2000A standard. The changes implemented did not need a new FAA type certificate, and actually kits were produced for NC-4 through NC-28. The 2000A featured a tuning fork noise dampeners and improved insulation for cabin noise. The exhausts were redesigned for more efficient airflow for the PT-6s. Stall strips were removed to provide shorter takeoff run, and lastly, the standpipes were removed from the fuel tanks. The standpipes artificially limited fuel capacity, much the same way a brick does in a toilet to reduce water usage. The removal gave the aircraft an additional 31 U.S. gallons. The 2000A had a revised interior. Also, the cabin was reduced from 8 passengers to 6. The advantage was that then a fully enclosed bathroom could be installed in the rear of the aircraft. With NC-53, the 50th production airframe, Beechcraft's Wichita plant ceased production in 1995. Raytheon may have sunk as much as $1 billion into the program. Supply chain issues, biting off more than you could chew, and too many new ideas in one airframe. Lastly, it wasn't a reliable aircraft. Ironically, the King Air, the aircraft it was supposed to replace, was one of the aircraft the Starship couldn't compete with. In 2003, Raytheon said, quote, "We are indeed decommissioning the fleet. We've made a business decision that because of the low number of aircraft in service and the specialized parts necessary to keep the aircraft flying, it did not make sense from a business standpoint to continue to support the aircraft," unquote. Any aircraft at that time were sent to Evergreen Air Center in Arizona. They were scrapped or incinerated. Beach would provide a Premier Jet or a King Air to anyone who surrendered their Starship to them. Evergreen eventually sold 24 ships back to clients for $50,000 apiece to be used primarily as spare parts. In 1995, the unit cost was $3.9 million U.S. dollars. As of January 2010, there were 9 aircraft with FAA registrations. NC-51 was used as a chase plane for Bert Rutan's Spaceship One program. Several have survived and are in various museums. The Beechcraft 2000 Starship was ahead of its time, so far ahead of its time that it couldn't keep up. Another example of an airframer trying to move the industry forward and failing because the rest of the industry wasn't ready or willing to keep up. So with that, that's the Beech Model 2000 Starship, and this is David M. Vanderhoof, your Airplane Geeks historian, signing off.
Thanks, David. That Model 115, an 85% scale, huh? Hi, if you go to 85, why not just go to 100? Any ideas?
No.
Okay.
85 is a number because I saw it in multiple places.
Yeah.
I don't know. It was Bert Rutan. He does what he wants to do, you know, and...
Nobody and questions that,
I was going to say, I wouldn't question him. And I think because of the control surfaces and the canard, he probably could have made a 1/4 scale, but it would look probably like a very easy. Yeah. I mean, the Starship was kind of a growth out of what he was building. So the 115 was 85%.
Interesting. All right, let's move on now to the Australia desk. Steve is back after his trip to the United States, and he's going to tell us all about that.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia news desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, 19th of October, 2014. Oi, Steve, knock it off. You're home now, mate. Get back into the work groove. Come on.
Back to reality. Here I am in the studio. Granted, it hardly seems like 5 minutes since I left.
Yeah, well, I didn't want to tell you, but you're still actually on the plane dreaming.
Yes, well, you know, jet lag is a wonderful thing. And, well, welcome to the Australia Desk, folks, I guess, for episode... Well, how many do I miss, Grant? Are we up to 321 yet?
We certainly are, mate. We certainly are. And just to help prove the fact that you're dreaming... Virgin Airways heard you were coming back, and they went out and bought Tiger Airways.
Well, how much did they pay for that, mate?
Oh, we'll get to that at the end, mate, because I think you're just going to freak.
Oh, boy. Okay, then. We'll wait with bated breath. Well, I tell you what, Las Vegas, what a place. What an experience. And I've never seen such humongous hotels in all my life.
Huge, huge hotels, laddie. But, yeah, you survived. And I was looking. I told you before you went, don't wind up on the set of CSI Las Vegas.
Yeah, well, I think the whole place is like a giant movie set, actually. In fact, we were driving through Death Valley at one stage, and it looked just like a movie set, actually. It was actually quite spectacular scenery. But, mate, I tell you what, we flew over there and back with Qantas and flew on an A380, something I've never done before. And I got to tell you, I was impressed with the 380. I was expecting it to be at least as noisy as a 747, on which I've ridden plenty of those. But it was actually very reasonably quiet, actually. Very, very smooth.
Yep, it has a great reputation for being very, very quiet and a lot of fun, especially if you get to be in the bigger seats for those of us who need the space, but unfortunately most of us can't afford it.
Well, here's an interesting thing, Grant. On the way over, they put us way, way down the back on the bottom deck. We went in economy class, of course, and we were in, I don't know, probably row 87 or 88. It was right down the back, and there was quite a reasonable amount of seat pitch, actually. You could really sort of stretch out. It was pretty good. But on the way back, they put us about the middle, I guess, in the row 54 or something like that. And I'm telling you, mate, those economy class seats are a lot closer together. I thought I was imagining it, but... I don't think I was.
Did you check on Seat Guru to see what they had to say?
Yeah, I did look on Seat Guru, actually, and it actually did warn me beforehand that the seats they'd given us were not exactly the best, and, well, they were right. Unfortunately for us, the flight back was absolutely chock-a-block full, so nothing much I could do. I did try to get, reassigned. In fact, one thing I didn't like was that Qantas's booking system split my family over three rows. I didn't really appreciate that too much.
Yeah, that's just ridiculous because, you all got the same surname except for... who tagged along, and you'd think that I'd put you all together because you're all in the one booking. That's most odd.
Yes, and that was a little bit annoying, but I tell you what, overall a fantastic experience. I've flown Qantas plenty of times in the past to Qantas International. I think the last time I flew overseas with them was 2007, and I'd have to say I wasn't overly impressed with them on that trip, but this time very impressed. The cabin crew were excellent. My son, in fact, had a bit of a medical emergency, or not an emergency, but a bit of an issue on the way back. And they couldn't have handled that with any more professionalism if they tried. It was really, really good. So thumbs up to Qantas, and you know, was also very good that I got to meet the captain of the flight over, and he was gracious enough to give my family a cockpit tour once we were safely on the ground at Los Angeles. So giving the VIP treatment, I was very, very pleased.
Well, I hear you got a bit of a VIP treatment in San Francisco with an aircraft.
I did indeed, yes. Now, a big shout-out to Airplane Geeks listener, and in fact, PCDU listener Fred Sampson, who was good enough to contact us and said, oh, by the way, I've got access to a nice 172S, a Cessna 172S, and for those playing along at home, that's a glass cockpit version of a Cessna 172. I've flown plenty of Cessna 172s. I've actually never flown a glass cockpit version with a G1000 panel, and really, really interesting. But talk about a bucket list Bravo. If many of our listeners are pilots and would know what Class B airspace is, Class Bravo. Fred managed to get us cleared, and we took off and went right over the top of San Francisco's International Airport, flew right around the bay, back and forth across the Golden Gate Bridge over Alcatraz. It was absolutely spectacular. It was right on sunset when we did this, and it was beautiful, smooth flying, and very bravely, Fred actually let me do most of the flying, so I appreciate that. We actually didn't manage to prang it into the bridge or anything, so a really, really wonderful experience, and it was great to get up there and be cleared, and I guess thanks should also go to the air traffic controllers there at SFO that day. They were very, very kind to us.
Yeah, we're going to have to raise this with the local air services guys and find out why on earth we can't do this in Melbourne, because that'd be great, track right over the top of Tulla.
Yeah, it would be good. Of course, I actually got in a bit of trouble for doing that one day many years ago. We shan't talk about that, but got some additional Cessna 172 time out of North Las Vegas Airport, thanks to Airwork Las Vegas. They're a member of the Rod Rakic's Open Airplane Organization, and they were very, very very generous to me. They let me take a 172 out with one of their instructors, Jackie Mass, and she did a great job of putting up with my interesting and well out of practice crosswind takeoff technique, but we did a fantastic tour around the skies of Las Vegas as well, and even managed to stick to landing eventually, mate. So I was pretty happy with that.
Nice. So do you reckon that following those couple of flights, you could jump into a single-seater and fly off a racetrack?
Well, I don't know about that. In fact, the Red Bull Air Race ended up being a bit of a fizzer that way because of the weather. On the practice day, they really got out there and strutted their stuff. But the winds really sprung up for the race day on the Sunday, and so much so that it was pushing the pylons, the air gates there over. In fact, Hannes Arch, the Austrian world champion, he went around and in his top 12 run and hit two pylons, which is unheard of for him, even to hit one, but to hit two. But I think it probably was more of a case of the pylons reaching out to hit him. That's how strong the winds were. So we got through to most of that top 12 round until we got to the Canadian Pete McLeod. He went to make his approach into the circuit and then just overflew it and decided that it was not safe to go in there. And that was quite interesting, Grant, because they actually didn't know what to do with themselves. Actually, it took them about an hour and a half before they could work out what to do. Eventually, they called off the race meeting altogether, and they ended up declaring Pete McLeod the winner because he had been the fastest qualified fire on the previous day. I don't know that's
like
really
Formula
the
one, mate. Sounds like Formula One.
Yeah, I don't know that that's the way that Pete McLeod would have really liked it to have been, but anyway, that's the way it worked out. Well done for him. And to be honest with you, some people are saying he doesn't deserve it on that basis, but I actually don't agree with that because Pete's really had a fantastic season. He was one of the backmarkers in the last season back in 2010, and he's really had a really solid season. So, I think he deserves it. And, we're hoping to talk to Pete McLeod from his base up there in Canada within the next few days, and we'll put that in the next episode of PCDU, Grant. But speaking of pilots who've had perhaps not such a great season, but still really good to talk to, was the American champion Kirby Chambliss, and I recorded an interview with him trackside. Kirby, not such a great season for you. You've had a bit of a struggle at the start of this season.
Oh yeah, so you had to bring that up. Thanks a lot.
About that.
No, and we're not going to get it fixed this season. We've got a lot of things in place in order to fix it for next year. We're a little bit behind the power curve on this. To say that I am frustrated would be like one of the biggest understatements in the world, especially in Dallas. I thought we had a pretty good shot at it there, and then some things just didn't go our way, and so super disappointed. I'm a very competitive person. I've won this thing twice. I mean, I've won the national championships and a lot of medals in world level competition, and so I'm a competitive person, and I'm very frustrated.
being here in front of your home audience, I guess, is a real motivating factor. I know the last, you're from Texas, I believe.
Right, yeah.
So that'll be a real motivating factor to get out there and really push it hard.
Sure, yeah. I mean, everybody's always asked me, like, when we're in Texas, I mean, I was born in Texas, and they're like, you know, is it special to win here? I said, it's special to win everywhere. But, yeah, of course, in your home country, you want to win, too. But I want to win everywhere. And so it's kind of a double-edged sword. You know, you have a lot of more media and also family and friends. And so, but you got to push all that out of your mind and focus on what you need to do, which is win.
There's been a lot of talk this season about the standardization, standardized propellers, standardized engines. How have you found that? Was that a transition for you, or were you already using this sort of equipment previously?
No, I mean, it was a transition, too, for, like, all of us, because we all had our own engine builders and stuff, and we could do a little bit more with them. You know, to say that they're all the same is, you know, there's no such thing. I mean, they're supposed to be within 2%. I don't know that they, you know, I think that they're close to that. But if you have 2%, even let's just say they're 2%, 2% is 3/4 of a second on the track.
Yeah, and that's all it takes, isn't it?
That's all it takes, you know. So we know we're a little bit slower on the straights right now. We fixed half of it. When we were in Malaysia, we were 10.4 knots slower just on the straights. So no matter what I would do, we were going to be slower than the front runners. We fixed about half of that now. We're about 5 knots or so slower than the front runners, and I'm hoping to be able to make that up here on the track.
You would be used to the density altitude here, obviously, coming from this part of the world.
Right.
I was talking to Matt Hall a bit about that earlier. That, I guess, is something that would make you feel a bit more comfortable flying in this part of the world compared to Europe?
I mean, well, we've all flown shows and stuff at density, you know, higher density altitude. Hell, I've flown air shows at 8,200 feet when it's 100 degrees, you know.
Wow,
so,
yeah.
And then the airplanes, you know, it's horrible. But the good thing about it is that we're all subject to the same conditions, you know. So I don't know that it's going to give me a huge advantage. I mean, I think these guys are, everybody's so experienced, you know, that... you know, everybody's quite good and a lot of experience doing this at different elevations and stuff, too.
I've been watching the Red Bull Air Race for many, many years, and it's interesting to contrast your flying style compared to, say, the British. You make a lot of very quick, deliberate, almost aggressive control inputs. It's obviously something that works for you. Where did that style come from originally? Is that the way you've flown air shows?
Yeah, I mean, with competition aerobatics, you know, we have a thing we call bumping off the line, so all the G comes on at one time, and it's to make the radiuses look the same. And for a judge, it's not important out here at all. I mean, I'm just trying to, you know, move the airplane as fast as I can move it from one gate to the next, you know. So you want to be smooth, but there's times that you just want to be super aggressive because, you know, if you take your time rolling, you're going the wrong way. You know, you got to get that airplane on its side and you got to pull it to go back the other way.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's when you need to be fast and aggressive.
And I suppose the pulling into some of those tight turns with the 10G limit now, that can be a challenge too, I imagine.
That affects us. You know, we were going over when it was 12. Now that they dropped it to 10, it definitely makes it harder because there's nothing, you know, people think that the airplane doesn't limit you. I mean, this airplane is set up to go plus or minus 12. That's its operating range. So it's more than happy to go over 10 Gs. And it happens so quick that, you know, it's all seat of the pants flying. I mean, from after I go through that start gate, I don't look down at the panel until I'm finished coming off the track. You know, there's no time. Those gates come up so fast.
So that really takes a lot of judgment on you. I was going to ask you if you had a G meter in the aircraft. But
there's one in there, but there's no way. I mean, by the time that you've pulled on the stick, you've hit the G. You know, you're in it. It'll go from 0 to 10 or 12 Gs in a fraction of a second.
Well, Kirby, it's a privilege to talk to you and a privilege to meet you after all these years of watching you. I wish you all the best for today in front of your home crowd.
Thank
and
you.
I hope it goes well.
Thank you. Nice to meet you. Appreciate
you.
It.
So there we go, Grant. I tell you what, it was. He's one of the pilots that we actually haven't interviewed before, Kirby Chambliss, and I thought a very frank talk there about how things are going and why things have not been working for both him and for Mike Gooley and the other American pilot in the series this year. If you want to go to our SoundCloud space at Playing Crazy Down Under, or even onto our Facebook page, you can hear all the interviews I did there at the Red Bull Air Race. I talked to Hannes Arch, Mike Gullion, and also talked to Matt Hall, the Australian, a couple of times. Obviously, we've got to support Matt Hall.
Hey, Matt.
Yeah, it was you know, interesting to get their perspectives on you know, what's going, you know, how it's been coming back into this season after that rather long break in between.
Well, mate, I've got to say that when that Kirby Chandler's interview started off, I thought we probably aren't going to get to interview him ever again, but he said settled in. It was okay, man. He settled
down.
Yeah,
I managed to smooth things over. Well, you know, I didn't really know what to say. But, you know, let's be honest, they're right at the bottom. I mean, those two guys. And, you know, they're really serious players, and they're out there to win. And, you know, I kind of feel sorry for them, particularly when the last two rounds have been in the US. I mean, it would have been good for them to at least come second in that hall.
Yeah, no, a podium at home is always a wonderful thing, let alone a podium anywhere. But, that's all pretty cool. But I think we're going to be running out of time and probably pushing the friendship with the boys. We can probably stretch it a little because you're back now. But, yeah, I think we probably should wrap this one up, mate.
Yes, we absolutely should. I should just mention, too, though, before we go, that unfortunately David was not able to make it. But fortunately for me, and I tell you, very fortunately, Grant, I was able to, and I should thank Stephen Frischling from Flying with Fish for really helping me out with this. So I managed to get a last-minute flight over to Philadelphia, a city I've never been to before, and managed to spend the day with David and his lovely wife, Michelle, and it was a really great experience. I can verify for all you listeners that, yes, David does, in fact, live very, very close to Philadelphia Airport. And David also took me to have a genuine Philly cheesesteak, and I can guarantee you that I am going back to that city because it was absolutely wonderful.
I'm so upset. I haven't had a real Philly cheesesteak in decades now. I'm so missing them. I've tried them in so many places and they just don't work. But anyway,
we better wrap this episode. We better wrap this Ozdesk up. But we can't sign off before you tell me how much did Virgin pay for Tiger Airways, mate?
Well, the word is, mate, they paid a whole dollar.
A whole dollar, eh? Well, looks like they got ripped off. I suppose we'll talk about that next week.
I know. I'm still shocked they paid a dollar to Singapore Airlines. Oh, Singapore Airlines are still asking for their 99 cents change, but anyhow.
Yeah, well, I still want my complaint answered. Anyway, we'll wait with bated breath until next week. I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarron.
I think I need a holiday, mate.
Oh, mate, it's such a stress being back in the studio for you. I know. I'm sorry, man. I had to drag you in, and I even had to get you up at 11 o'clock in the morning.
All right. Steve sent along some photos from his trip, David, including one with you and he in the famous tailhook.
Yeah, we had a great. It was a short visit, but we had a really good time, and it was quite special having him fly all the way over to just to see us for a couple of days, and it was fun watching him eat a cheesesteak, which is pretty much the standing order, you know, my standing offer for anybody if you're coming to Philadelphia. And you have a little bit of notice, you can always get your picture taken with the tailhook, and we'll take you out for cheesesteak.
And I spent 5 years in the Philly area, and my favorite place was Rose Trees, which is out near Media, but I think they're gone now. But yeah, I lived on cheesesteaks, and I sure miss them, and they are fantastic.
Yeah, I want to follow up, too, and listen to the other interviews that Steve did at the Vegas Air Races with some of the other pilots. Those are always interesting. Well, thank him for including the one with Kirby Chambliss. Really interesting to hear from him. And we appreciate that, Steve. And rest up. I think Grant's probably happy to see you back. And we'll look forward to some more great Ozdesks. But now it's time for Peter Johnson with our European perspective across the pond.
Today, I welcome back Flight Chic herself, Marissa Garcia. Marissa, welcome back across the pond.
Thank you. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. I know you've been a little under the weather, so thanks very much for joining us. Okay, well, let's start with some news stories. I did recently talk about Finnair, and Finnair are back in the news again, this time for biofuel. Are they doing anything different to anyone else?
Well, I think it's pretty innovative that they're looking at reusing cooking oil. You know, I think that is very clever because you're going to produce that anyway. So a byproduct of everyday life. A lot of innovations are out there for alternative fuels. And I think that's within the industry, especially both Airbus and Boeing are trying different things out. So it's, you know, it's an ongoing thing. Yeah. But I think it's great that Finnair took their own initiative and looked at the use of cooking oil. I found it very amusing and really pretty cool. You know, that of course it's not financially viable yet. That they emphasized that. But it was also a very nice thing for them to do during the UN climate summit.
Yeah.
So it gave a little bit more excitement to the summit.
And what aircraft were they using for these tests?
They're A330s.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Do you know what they were doing in terms of the balance? Was it high biofuel mix or low, or was it really just testing the concept?
No, it was completely a test concept, and they have no real expectations that that's going to be an ongoing viable product. It was just something that they put together with Sky Energy, in order to demonstrate that there's a different way to think about aircraft fuel, of producing Jet A. Now, again, will it be made that way? Will cooking oil finally fuel our aircraft? There's really no way to know that, but there are a lot of alternatives out there. And the point is that we can't just rely on petroleum sources, and there's got to be a better way to do it, a greener way.
Yeah. And also on your website, I picked up a story a couple of weeks ago about their growth in cargo as well. Finnair are really punching above their weight at the moment, aren't they?
Well, they're being very savvy. You know, they're really trying to build up Helsinki as a hub of the Nordic region. They really want to get both the airline business and the airport to be strong competitors for the crossover from Asia to the West. And they're in a prime position to do that. It's a great route.
Yeah.
And they're really just being creative about it. And yes, cargo is a very important element of airline revenue and a very important service internationally. Air cargo is invaluable. In fact, Boeing just announced that it has projections of significant growth in air cargo over the coming years. So, it's a good thing for them to be looking after as well. And I like that they're looking at the pharmaceutical sector in particular, because it's such a necessary cargo. You know, it's vital. So it was clever of them to get involved with getting certified to carry those pharmaceuticals.
Yeah, very interesting. A niche segment, but they're trying to make it all their own. You mentioned Helsinki there and the airport, big growth plans.
Yes. And the nice thing about it is they're making neat plans for themselves. You know, they're going to make a all under one roof set up. And right. I think it's going to be lovely. They really go into the quality of the airport experience. And a lot of airports are doing innovative things. But Helsinki is really looking out for passengers wanting to stay and do things there and spend their time, either health activities or diversions. It's really, really pretty cool.
Yeah. Okay, just before we leave this part of the world then, Denmark have a very strong UAV program. I didn't know much about it, but they're looking to see if they can push for some more innovation in the sector.
Yes, I was pretty impressed to find that out myself. I feel pretty proud of Denmark for this, because I'm a huge UAV fan. And they've made a commitment that it's an important technology and they want to be at the forefront of it. And it makes a lot of sense for Danish culture because, Max Flight originally got me interested into it, I have to say. And, he pointed out the agrarian benefits, in terms of farm management. And there's so many farms over here. It's a large portion of the country is farming. So for that purpose, and also for the petroleum industry, it makes a lot of sense. But then there's also search and rescue, which is, quite important over here with the North Sea. So, there's a big organization to really promote it here. And, there's a new manufacturer that just made a deal with Boeing for a new smart drone. And they are also a Danish company called Skywatch.
Right, okay.
It's a very cute little drone. It could be very, very well used in a number of applications. So I think it's something exciting to watch.
Good. Well, we will watch out for that. Unfortunately, we've run out of time today, Marissa, but will you come back next week? Because I want to talk to you about some of the other things going on in your world. Very exciting times.
Absolutely, anytime you need.
Whereabouts can we find you online?
Well, I'm always at flightchic.com. That's my home base. And of course, I have articles also on skiff.com.
Marissa, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Peter and Marissa. All right. Let's move on quickly to some listener mail. We've got time for just a couple of them. First, we heard from Hoovinson again. This is a photo that he took, and we'll put this in the show notes. He says he took this sometime in November 2010 in the section of Ninoy Aquino International Airport in the Philippines. And this is where they park old derelict airplanes. And if you look carefully in this picture, you see what he believes is the Lockheed Constellation that the Qantas Founders Museum purchased. Earlier we talked about that, or previously we talked about that. There's also DC-3, Antonov AN-24, I guess. David, that looks like the Constellation, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's... If we put the picture in the show notes, it's directly behind the coot and the DC-3. You see the three tails sitting there. So, yeah, it's definitely a Connie.
Very good. So, thanks, Hoovinson. And also we heard from Tony Davis, who writes, thanks for the great show every week. I especially love the interview with the Blackbird pilot in Bits and Pieces 13. That was fantastic. He says, anyway, I was wondering if you would be kind enough to be able to help me out with some travel advice. Now, he lives in Sydney, Australia, and he says that he and his uncle are going to make a trip to AirVenture next year, and that he's looking at, kind of a nice itinerary, looking to spend the bulk of the time in Oshkosh, and then 1 or 2 days at the U.S. Air Force Museum in Dayton, and then a day at the Udvar-Hazy Center. He said he's never been to the U.S. before, plans on making another trip with his wife and kids later to see the non-AV geeky stuff. But he gave us sort of his planned itinerary and sort of asked for some advice, which, I'm not the one to ask. So I pointed him towards Cranky Concierge. Brett Snyder runs that site. We've mentioned that before. We know that Micah has used them. Our listener Micah has used crankyconcierge.com before. And they do some great trip planning and flight following and things like that. So just in general, if you're planning a trip, particularly through some areas that you're not familiar with, or some airlines that you're not familiar with, if it's a little bit tricky, a service like that can be very, very useful, and also provide a lot of peace of mind and help should things go awry.
Well, I can give him a non-cranky answer to that question.
Sure.
In terms of which airlines fly into Oshkosh. None. You can't get there by airline. The closest airline service is into Appleton, which is, 20, 25 minutes away, and that's very poor service. And then after Milwaukee. That, it's going to be Milwaukee or Green Bay are probably, I'd say Green Bay is closer at 45 minutes. Milwaukee's probably over an hour. My favorite is, frankly, just flying to Chicago. So, drive from Chicago. That's the best way to go.
Right. I think, a lot of people do that, then rent cars and get to the site that way.
Yeah.
It's not a bad ride up from Chicago to Oshkosh.
How long does that take to drive?
It's 3 hours unless you hit a bad traffic jam. A little bit further from Midway where Southwest comes in, just a tiny bit shorter from O'Hare.
Okay, good. We also heard from Marissa, not the same Marissa that Peter talked to, a different Marissa. And Marissa says, in January, I'm going to start school at Lewis University, majoring in aviation. Writes, my uncle was a pilot, and when I was a child, he used to sneak me up to Oshkosh in every airport he could think of and get me flying without my parents knowing. She says, anyway, I went to college and forgot about my dream, but every time I looked up, I remembered what it was like, and now I know this is what I want to do. My uncle said he would love to help me, but he recently passed away from pancreatic cancer. Sorry to hear that, certainly. My family thinks I'm crazy like they thought he was crazy. I can't imagine my future stuck on the ground. The point of this whole thing is that I was hoping you could point me in the direction of scholarships. My GPA right now is 3.6, so that's not a problem. It's just finding the scholarships. And Marissa closes, I love the podcast and find them super helpful. I also love the t-shirts. Well, thanks for that, Marissa. I think that about one of the best, well, there's a couple of sources. One is aviationcareerspodcast.com. And they have a scholarship section of that website, which lists many, 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 many scholarships. And we'll put a link to that in the show notes. And also, earlier, Binet pointed out that AOPA has a scholarship post that she wrote, I think, from fairly recently. And that's got a kind of a complicated link. So we'll put that in the show notes as well. Also, Women in Aviation has lots of them. And that's at wai.org/education/scholarships.cfm. So there's some sources for scholarships for Marissa or anyone else looking for that way to fund their flying education. And we'll put, again, all those in the show notes.
Oh, and definitely look at Women in Aviation, which does a lot of scholarships in the 99s. And it's interesting, we had some remodeling going on here, and the contractor mentioned to me that his son is running through his scholarship money for his pilot license. And I think that's the problem. Most of the scholarships do not cover anywhere close to the full cost of pilot training. So my advice to him, which was too late, was go ahead and save up as much as you can beforehand, because if you run through the money and then have to stop, it's just going to cost more, because it'll you'll have forgotten things and you'll have to spend money relearning those things.
Sure.
So, yeah, I think the the old adage of find that part-time job at the airport is probably applicable here as well, Marissa.
Absolutely. Good advice. All right. Well, that'll do it for this episode. I want to thank you all for listening to episode 321 of the Airplane Geeks podcast. You can find show notes at airplanegeeks.com/321. And we want to thank our guest, Binet Wilson. You can find the Airways News blog at airwaysnews.com. Also, their Twitter handle is Airways News. And you can also take a look at Binet's personal page, aviationqueen.com. And her Twitter handle is avqueenbinet, B-E-N-E-T. If you'd like to find us or our contributors online, you can visit airplanegeeks.net. And that's where you can learn more about Airplane Geeks, this podcast, the Jetwine blog that Rob does, the UAV Digest that David and I do, also his blog, What Just Flew By, and Plane Crazy Down Under and Aviation Extended as well. And you'll find links to those websites, recent episodes, all of that kind of information there at airplanegeeks.net. And we want to thank Max Trescott for joining us this week. Max, where can folks find you?
Thanks, David. That's nice. Well, they can find me in person next week down in Palm Springs. I'll be at the Aviation Expo, which starts on October the 30th. They'll have their parade of planes, and then I'll be speaking a couple of days there. It runs through Sunday, the 2nd of November. So come on down there if you're anywhere near Southern California. And then they can find me in all the usual places like Facebook.com. In fact, I had a listener just contact me recently, Pedro Diaz, interested in flight training, was listening here on the podcast. So
fantastic.
I can be found on Facebook and lots of other places.
Always a pleasure to have you. David, good to speak with you again. You and I will talk in a few days for the UAV Digest.
Yep. Looking forward to it. And yes, Max, we'll have to have you on the other show at some point.
Yep. It'll be fun to drone on with you.
Yeah. Okay. Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. So join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Thanks for listening.
And keep the blue side up.
All hail the queen.
You're back.
Very good.
No, it's God save the queen, please.
My country, 'tis of thee, sweet land of liberty, of thee I sing. I almost got beat by a Brit once when I sang that in front of the Queen, accidentally.
As you should have been.
And I'm laughing because, you know, at least Rob's not on. So.
Why is that?
Oh, because he would be having a field day right now.
Yeah.
Oh, picking on you?
Yes. I David and Max are always so kind, but...
Oh. Well,
Rob
you should know.
Just has no filter.